Many people who were there understand. When it was time to register folk to vote, many times many of us would go into their homes, and it was the first time they'd ever registered to vote, and you had to promise, we say, I'll take care of the baby if you'll go down and register. I'll wash your clothes. I'm serious. I'll cut your grass. I'll do anything if you will go down and vote. And so often, the people who did these kinds of things were never fully appreciated. Dr. King understood it, and therefore he mentioned it when he received his Nobel Prize. This whole work also is a threatening work. It is very, very dangerous work, because the evil we face is systemic. It is an old evil. And many times it's dressed up in new clothing, but it's still the same old stuff. And therefore, as we look at the realities of civil rights activism, and we look at the hurdles that must be crossed, it makes this lady so unique. Mrs. Amelia Robinson was one of the persons who marched at the Edmund Pettus Bridge on May 7, 1965. She was beaten so badly, they thought she was dead. It was a horrible, horrible day. I can speak to that. I was a young 17-year-old kid at that time, and I have such respect for those adults who went through the horror of that hour, and yet maintained a sweet and blessed spirit. From the 1930s, Mrs. Robinson and her husband involved themselves in the fights for voting rights and property ownership throughout the state of Alabama. During the 1960s, in her home in Selma and her office, she often invited the King leadership team, Dr. King himself, and many times they put together strategies that worked. In 1964, she was the first African-American, but also the first female who ran on the Democratic ticket for Congress. Today, Ms. Robinson is a leading member and vice chairman of the Schiller Institute, founded by Lyndon LaRouche and Helga Zepp LaRouche. Am I correct in that pronunciation? Good. In 1984. In April and May of 1990, Mrs. Robinson spent 5 weeks touring East and West Germany for the Schiller Institute, where she addressed thousands and thousands of German citizens about the lessons from the life of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. On July 21st, 1990, Mrs. Robinson was awarded the Martin Luther King Jr. Freedom Medal, honoring her lifelong commitment to human rights and civil rights. Today, in her 90s, and I want to talk to her before she leaves here. Whatever she's been drinking, I want a bottle of it. Today, in her 90s, Mrs. Robinson is still a vibrant, charismatic leader, touring the nation and speaking for the Schiller Institute on the behalf of the principles of civil rights and activism. Would you be kind enough to give a warm Talladega County welcome to Ms. Amelia Robinson?
A beautiful tribute. But that tribute makes me realize that I still have a lot to do.
Amen.
God is not through with me yet. And I will be here. I happen to be in the B class. I never was supposed to be a very smart person. I'm in the B class. So I'm going to be here. And I hope I will be here to see every one of you become a registered voter. Amen. And use your vote in order that we can destroy the evils,
yes,
that we have in our country.
My Lord.
And I believe that Martin is looking down now, Martin Luther King, whom to me was just Martin, because I'm old enough for his mother. And when he came to Selma, people rejected him.
That's right. That's right.
I believe we could make a type of plan that we are going in different places, and we are going to get people to realize that a voteless people is a hopeless people. And the only way that we are going to be able to get our rights is to get the ballot. And when we were small, we used to decide that we're going to make a resolution. And of course, every year the resolution was, I'm not going to tell any more stories or lies. But I would like to see you make a resolution on this day, a resolution that I am going to become a registered voter, if you're not, because if you haven't voted in 2 years, you've lost. That you are going to exercise your ability as an American citizen and vote. I would like for you to make that resolution this day, that you're going to exercise your God-given rights and become a registered voter. I worked with Dr. King, and I cried when he came to Selma, because on the street that my office was on, we had all of the professional African Americans. Not one of them came to him and said, thank you for coming. I am glad that you're here. I would like to give you a drink of water, or I would like for you to come to my house. Nobody. Because you have evil against good. And the people who were evil feared,
that's right,
getting together.
Yes.
Because they were very successful in dividing and conquering. So they said, don't have Dr. King to come into Selma. They even called me, because he's a rabble-rouser. He's an agitator. He's a communist. And most of them didn't know what communism was, but that's what the white folks say, so we are not going to have anything to do with it. And some of these professional people closed their doors. And the only place he had to go was to my office and to the house, so I turned everything over to them.
Amen.
And thank God, out of that came, as you know, not only Resurrection City, but also the March the 7th, which was known as Bloody Sunday. So I would like for you to make that resolution this day, that you are going to follow in the footsteps of Dr. King, the little thing, to register, vote, and become a first-class citizen. He was rejected, but so was Christ. Mahatma Gandhi was rejected. Kennedy was rejected. Martin Luther King was rejected. But all of them left footprints on the sand of time. But you know, God has leaders to take up the helm,
my Lord,
and to have somebody to carry it on. And we have this day a man who's walking in the footsteps of all of these people, a combination of trying to right the wrongs. Unfortunately, we went to sleep after 1965. Until 1967, people got positions. And they fought for it. But the young generation feels as though it has everything made. We don't have to do. We can go in any hotel. We can go into any restaurant. We don't have to sit in the back of the bus. But you don't have it made. The evil spirit, like a mold. I don't know whether you know anything about molds or not. But in my grandmother's home in South Carolina, we would see the ground breaking. We couldn't see what was under it. But there's something like a mold. And as it goes along, it breaks the ground. So you don't be like the mole. You come up to the top and break the ground and break out. Because self-esteem is something that everybody can have. You are your brother's keeper. You are God's child. And we know that we have to have leaders. This is something that I would like for each and every one of us to realize, that leaders are not those that feel that, well, I want to be a leader tomorrow, and I'm going to lead. God makes leaders, and we refine those leaders. Thank God that we are now at the place that we don't look at the color of the skin, but the contents of a man's character, regardless of whom he might be. But we have to fight hate. And I am so happy that the gentleman whom I am sitting or standing beside is a man who will tell anybody, hate does not help. Hate only destroys the hater.
Amen.
It used to be a time that people of color were hated because of the color of their skin. But hate is like, it's like a cancer. It starts sometime with just a little pimple. And if you don't stop it, it grows. It grows into a sore. Then it takes over the whole body. And that's what hate has done. It's not because of the color of a person's skin that people are hated now only. It's gone into our cities, our counties, and even our nation. They hate. And this is one man. Talk with him day or night. Wake him up, and he'll tell you that love can overcome everything. Amen. That we have to love. We have to look at the person's inside. And I am very proud to say that this gentleman is a man that I have known for many years. And it's not because of what somebody said. Like Martin. When Martin Luther King, before he came into Selma, Martin Luther King was told that don't go into that section. He was hated. But he did what he was supposed to have done. And that is what God had him to do. And then he took him away. If he were living today, maybe the rabble-rousers might have killed him physically, mentally, rather than physically. But he did the job that God had him to do. And I think of people as, let's say, a school. Here, the teacher comes in and says that I'm going to give an examination today. And I want you to take your papers and pencils out, and we're going to have an examination. Okay? In this class, you have Martin Luther King, you have Mahatma Gandhi, you have many other people, including the Kennedys, including Lincoln, you have Lyndon LaRouche, And because of my age, you got me. Then the teacher says, she passes out the examination. Then she says, now, I want you to be sure that you're quiet and do your work. And as soon as she turns her back, you find, let's say, Martin Luther King. Miss teacher, I've finished. Bring your paper up here. She looks at it. You have a perfect score. You may pass on. And he passes off of the scene of this earth.
All right.
And
all
God right. says, right. come up a little higher. You've done a good job.
All right, all right.
The candidates, 15 minutes afterward, the same thing. Okay, you've got a good score. You may pass. But 40 minutes pass. The time is only 45 minutes. 40 minutes pass. Many of the people have finished their examination, and they pass on. 45 minutes pass. The bell has rung. And Lyndon and Arusha and I are still working. So we are here for a purpose. And I am so happy to see a man that knows no color. He's colorblind. He is working for people, for the human race. And he realizes that we are our brother's keeper, whether we are on this side of the ocean or the other side. And he realizes also, unless people throughout the world begin to recognize people, justice, understanding, love, humility, then we have not completed our job. So I introduce to some of you, present to others, the man that God has ordained as a leader for people throughout the world, Lyndon H. LaRouche.
Thank you, young lady. Oh, thank you, Amelia.
Bless your heart.
See, she's very special to us, and to my wife, when I say we, my wife as well. She's been like a mother to my wife, and she's precious. We have two problems, I think, which should be the basis for reflecting on Martin's life today. One, we have a national crisis. Now, I'm not going to mince words, and I'm not going to do any political hacking, but the facts have to be told. This economy is collapsing. The situation, relatively speaking, in terms of basic economic infrastructure of the United States today is worse than in 1933 when Roosevelt came into the White House in March. That is, you look around you, infrastructure, energy, so forth, the conditions of life of our people around the world. And don't look in the big cities where they put on a facade and say things are fine. Look in the communities. For example, Detroit now has half the population it used to have. An industrial city is gone. Look around Birmingham. You see how the same thing is reported. It was never rich, but their sense of loss, of loss, of loss, of this, that. That's the situation of the United States. Then you've got an indifference to the problems of the United States. Okay, we have 48 at least of the 50 states are bankrupt, hopelessly bankrupt. That is, the states cannot possibly raise the tax revenue without sinking the economy further to meet the essential obligations of government. This is characteristic of at least 48 states. And it's getting worse. If you look at the cost of living, the increase of the cost of living, as compared to what is officially reported, look at the prices of food in grocery stores over the past 6 months in the United States. Look at the fact that the U.S. dollar, which not long ago was 83 cents would buy a euro. Today it takes $1.26 or $1.28 to buy a euro. The U.S. dollar is collapsing in value. What is increasing is the amount of money associated with gambling. And the biggest form of gambling is occurring on Wall Street. The money is going into drive up for purely speculative way on side bets on the economy to drive up the value of stock prices for some countries. And as soon as some company gets rich, the leaders of the company go to prison, like Enron. Because we have gone from the steel business to the stealing business. The nature of the economy. We're in trouble. We're in trouble on a world scale. Since January of 2002, when the president made an unfortunate speech in the State of the Union address, the attitude toward the United States has fallen rapidly to the lowest I've ever seen among nations all over the world. Throughout Eurasia, throughout the Americas, the United States is despised where it was still at least respected or even loved before. We are in trouble. And look at the world. The world faces a great crisis. And the United States faces a great crisis in dealing with the world. The largest concentrations of population of the world are China, for example, 1.3 billion or more, India, over 1 billion. Then you have Pakistan, Bangladesh, and the countries of Southeast Asia. This is the greatest concentration of population on this planet. It's an emerging part of the world. The question is, what's the relationship of the United States to these people of Asia, who represent, in by and large, different cultural backgrounds than those of us in the United States or in Western Europe? How are we going to find peace in a troubled world? How are we going to find reconciliation in a troubled world with countries which have turned against us because of the war policies of Cheney and some others? So we face the situation. Now go back a little bit to the time that Bill Clinton was inaugurated as president. Now think about something some of you know about. Think about the status of the Black Caucus, Legislative Caucus, and the Black Congressional Caucus in 1993, when Bill Clinton came into the White House. Now go through the list of names. Where are those people and their replacements today? There has been a winnowing out of the political achievements throughout the country of the Black caucuses. Right. This is the problem I deal with constantly. From 1996 on, it became worse, accelerated, brutally. So we do not face a new problem today, in one sense. We face the same problem in principle that Martin faced, and faced successfully. And I would propose that in the lesson of Martin Luther King and his life, there is something we can learn today which brings him back to life as if he was standing here alive today. There's something special about his life, his development, which should be captured today by us, not only in addressing the problems of our nation, which are becoming terrible, but the problems of our relationship with the world as a whole. How are we going to deal with these cultures that are different than our own? With an Asian culture, with Muslim cultures around the world, one over a billion Muslims around the world, with the culture of China, which is different than ours, the culture of Southeast Asia, which is different than ours, the cultural background. They're all human, they all have the same ultimate requirements, the same needs. But they're different cultures. They think differently. They respond to different predicates than we respond to. But we must have peaceful cooperation with these people to solve a world problem. Then you start thinking about someone like Martin. And I want to indicate in the context I just stated what the significance of Martin is today. We had no replacement for Martin. Lesson number one.
Martin was a unique personality. He was not a talented person who happened to stumble into leadership and could be easily replaced by other leaders who would learn the job and take over afterward. We had no replacement. No one in the position to replace him. Many wished to be, they didn't have it. What did Martin have? What was the essence of Martin that put him above, made him something special? Let's compare three cases to get at this. One, Martin himself. The other, the case of France's famous heroine, Jeanne d'Arc. And I'm rather familiar with the details of the actual history of the Jeanne d'Arc case, which is comparable in a sense, a very special way, to the case of Martin. And then also with a fictitious case, which points to the problem we face, the case of Shakespeare's Hamlet, especially the Hamlet of the third act's soliloquy. Now, what was the issue? Martin was truly a man of God. Truly. In a way that very few people are actually able to realize in their lifetime. It wasn't just that he was a man of God, it's that he rose to the fuller appreciation of what that meant. Obviously, the image for him was Christ and the passion and crucifixion of Jesus Christ. That was his source of strength. He lived that. He had gone to the mountaintop at a point that he knew his life was threatened by powerful forces in the United States. And he said, I will not shrink from this mission, even if they kill me. Just as Christ said, and I'm sure that was in Martin's mind at that point. The passion and crucifixion of Christ is the image which is the essence of Christianity. It's an image, for example, in Germany or elsewhere where the Bach St. Matthew Passion is performed. It's a 2-hour performance, approximately. And those 2 hours, the audience, the congregation, the singers, the musicians, relive in a powerful way the passion and crucifixion of Christ. And this has always been important. To relive that, to capture the essence of what Christ means for all Christians. And Martin showed that. The difference is this, and I'll come back to Jeanne d'Arc, or called Joan of Arc in English. The difference is, most people tend to believe, yes, I wish to go to heaven, or something like that. Or don't care. But they are looking for answers within the bounds of their mortal life. They're thinking of the satisfactions of the flesh, the security they will enjoy between the bounds of birth and death. Whereas the great leader, like Martin, rises to a higher level, they think of their life as the Gospel presents it as a talent. As a life is a talent given to you. You're born and you die. That is your talent and what you have in that period. The question is, you're going to spend it anyway. How are you going to spend it? What are you going to spend it to secure for all eternity? What are you going to do as a mission that will earn you the place you want to occupy in eternity? Martin had a clear sense of that. That mountaintop address for me, it struck me years ago, clear, it was just a clear understanding of exactly what he was saying, what he was saying to others. Life is a talent. It is not what you get out of life, it's what you put into it that counts. Martin had that. That's why he was a leader, and I've known many of the other leaders with him in that period. They didn't quite have the same spark. They may have accepted the idea, they may have believed in it, but it didn't grip them the same way it did Martin. And it came to grip him, I'm sure, more and more as he took on more and more responsibilities. As a leader, you feel this. You see your people. You see the things you have to cope with, the suffering. You see the danger. And you have to find within yourself the strength not to flinch, not to compromise. Take the case of Jeanne d'Arc to the comparison. Joan of Arc, she called. And this is the real history. She was such a significant figure in the 15th century that her history was thoroughly documented at the time and cross-checked and so forth. She was a figure in all Christianity. She was a key figure in the history of France. Here she is, a woman, a young woman, coming from a farming background, who is inspired to believe that France must be freed from the terrible occupation of the Norman chivalry, that France must become a true nation, and that it must be risen out of its condition to become a nation to take care of these problems. She says that God wished this to happen. So she went to a series of events to a prince who was the heir nominally to the throne of France. And she said to this prince, have gotten in there with various credentials, God wants you to become king. And he looked at her and he said, what do you want from me? I said, I don't want anything from you. God wants you to become a king. And so, because of her power of her personality and her mission, the king gave her the command of some troops in a very serious battle at that time, on the assumption that she would be killed as a leader of these troops, and that would settle the whole problem. She wasn't killed. She won the battle, personally leading the battle. And France was mobilized for its independence. The idea of its independence to a large degree as a result. Then the time came that the king was crowned, or the prince was crowned king. But then the king betrayed her to the enemies of France, to the British, the Normans. And she was put on trial by the Inquisition, which is a horrible thing. This is the worst kind of injustice you can imagine. And at the course of the trial, she was offered bait. If you will back off a little bit, girl, we won't burn you at the stake alive. And what they did, she said no. She flinched. Maybe I should compromise. She had priests in there trying to get her to compromise. She said, I won't compromise. I cannot betray my mission. She had gone to the mountaintop. I will not betray my mission. I will stay my course. So they took her. They tied her to a stake. They piled the wood on the stake. They set fire to the stake while she's alive. They cooked her to death. Then they opened the pile of wood to see if she was alive or not. They found she was dead. And they continued the process, restarted the fire, and burned her into ashes. But out of that, two things happened. Out of that, France revived and got its independence, and later got the first modern nation-state of Louis XI, that is, Louis XI of France. And the significance of that is this for us today. Because of that victory, because of what happened with Louis XI of France, we had the first European state in which all of the government was responsible for the general welfare of all of the people. The general welfare means exactly what it means in 1 Corinthians 13, when Paul writes of agape, or sometimes called love or charity. It's that quality. It is not the law, it is not the rule book that counts. It's your love of humanity that counts, that you must always live for your love of humanity. And therefore, government is not legitimate, except his government is officially committed to the general welfare of not only all of the people, but also the improvement of the condition of life of their posterity. And for the first time in France, with that state, the principle of constitutional law that government cannot treat some of the people as human cattle. It is not legitimate. It is not a nation if it treats some of its people as human cattle. It must think of the general welfare of all of the people. It must be captured by a sense of responsibility to all of the people and to their posterity. Because we are all mortal. And to arouse in us the passions while we're alive, which will impel us to do good, we have to have a sense that our life and the consuming of our life, the spending of our talent, is going to mean something for coming generations. The best people look for things that, like Moses, that are going to happen when he will no longer be around to enjoy them. It's this sense of immortality. It's why parents, in the best degree, sacrifice for their children. It's why communities sacrifice for education for their children, for opportunities for their children. You go the pangs of suffering and shortage, but you have a sense that you're going someplace, that your life is going to mean something, that you can die with a smile on your face. You've conquered death. Your life, you've spent your talent wisely. Why life will mean something better for generations to come. That was the principle. That principle inspired the plan of King Henry VII of England to do the same thing against the evil Richard III and establish England at that time as the second modern nation state. In a sense, that's what Martin was doing, the same kind of process. But now let's take the other side of the thing. Let's take the case of Hamlet. Hamlet says that we have the opportunity to fight, to free ourselves from horrible conditions, but what happens after we die? What happens beyond death? And it is the fear of what happens beyond death which makes people cowards. And that is our problem in the United States today. It's the problem of our leadership in the Democratic Party, it's the problem in the Republican Party, because not all Republicans are bad. Some of them are very good. I intend to incorporate some of them in my government. I'm not very partisan when it comes to government. I'm partisan about getting it established. So that's the point. The problem here is this. Actually believe that man is different than an animal. Do you think in the schools today, in the newspapers today, do you think that Americans believe in any significant way that man is different than an animal? We don't teach that. Look at our standard curriculum. Many of you know something about education. It's what our education policies now nationally are a crime. You don't know anything, you learn to pass a test. And you wonder if the person who designs the test knows what they're talking about. Yeah. You have tests are issued in various parts of the country, not to test what you've done to the students in terms of what they know. Sometimes the students come out saying, I know nothing. Honor students say, in my years in secondary school, I learned nothing the way it's being taught now under the standard now. What they're testing is the obedience training of the students in that school district or that part of the country as measured by some standard. Districts are competing for money. And the performance, like the dog training of the students in the school, becomes a standard for how much money and how many honors that district will get in the following year. We're no longer concerned. We don't believe as a nation. We don't believe in developing people. We have become like Rome, ancient Rome, a society of bread and circuses. Get your crumbs and be entertained. And the entertainment gets more and more vicious as it goes along. For example, today, do people work? Is their mentality one of working? Do they believe in work? Do they believe the society gives them the opportunity to work? No. It doesn't. Gives them the opportunity to get some money. What is the biggest growth industry in the United States? Gambling. What is Wall Street? Gambling. What is Enron? Gambling. What are these guys that are going to jail in New York? Gamblers. The mentality of the country is that if you're getting lucky and winning the lottery and winning at the track, that you're getting ahead. Even though your industry is collapsing, your farm is gone, the city government can no longer afford to take care of your essential needs, we've gone into become a gambling society. We rely on what? Mass entertainment. What kind of mass entertainment? Is it something you really should be ashamed of? We no longer regard human beings as human. We no longer understand what is human. I've started a youth movement some 4 years ago. It concentrates on young people 18 to 25 years of age. That is the university age group. And as you know, people when they get to about 18 to 25 under normal conditions have passed over from thinking of themselves as adolescents, as being half adults, half children, into becoming, in a sense, adults. They have adult confidence, adult impulses, and so forth. They are ready to assume responsibility in society. In a well-ordered society, everyone would have a quality type of university education accessible to them. So in order to develop the talent of each person to find out what their mission in life should be, what kind of career they should adopt, and to give them the opportunity to work through fighting that out and finding out who they really are as an adult and choosing their profession in future life on that basis. In that kind of, what I emphasize in that training is understand the difference between man and the beast. Now, I'm going to get a little bit technical at this point, but it's an important point. What is the difference between man and beast? Can you prove that man is not just an animal? And how can you prove it? If man were an ape, for example, the population of human beings on this planet would never have exceeded several million individuals. So don't make a monkey out of man. We have now over 6 billion people on this planet to take care of, and they're growing. The point is that man has been able to discover what no animal can do, to discover universal physical principles of the universe, to apply these discovered principles to make improvements in society, which increases man's power over nature. Just as you can read in Genesis 1, man and woman made equally in the image of the Creator, in the likeness of the Creator, and responsible for this function. That's what we are. When we teach physical science, when we teach classical art and things like that, when we teach history from that standpoint, we are actually imparting to young people a sense of their humanity. They are capable of reenacting the great discoveries of principle from the past, whether in art or whether in physical science. When they know that, they know the difference between themselves and the beast. They pride themselves on this. And they say, we're human. And they can look at each other with love, a kind of love which is expressed in education by the proper kind of class, in which students share in the process of fighting through the act of discovering for themselves a principle presented to them as a challenge and a paradox. I mean, there's a loving relationship, a class of size of 15 to 25 typical good university, good secondary school class, in which the students are given the responsibility, given a challenge, to try to fight it through among themselves. And the good teacher tries to evoke this kind of response from among the students, find two or three in the class that will start the discussion, and try to get the entire class involved in the discussion. So that what comes out of that is not memorizing something in a textbook. What comes out of that is the process of a social experience of discovering the meaning of a principle as if they had made the original discovery themselves. This is done not by teaching the individual student, though that sometimes works. It's done by getting the students to interact in the process of discussion. That's why you want a class size of between 15 and 25. Not too many to exclude the opportunity for people to participate. Not too few, so you don't get the stimulation of starting the discussion. But it's this social process of relationship among people who love each other in a higher sense because they have shared the process of discovery of a principle, or they've understood something about history, but they've shared it. And the idea of sharing human knowledge as human knowledge is the essential act of loving. And you love mankind and you're happy with mankind when you have worked together to make a discovery together with people. And you realize you can rely on those people for that kind of method. You got a problem with them? Well, go back to the method. Talk to them the same way you do in the classroom. Fight it out with them. And these young people are fun. They fight it out till 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. I usually, when I give a lecture with these guys, they go at me for about 4 hours. I give them about 1 hour presentation or something like that, and they're at me, all over the place. But it's beautiful, it's wonderful. And I think anybody who's been in education knows exactly what I'm talking about. It's beautiful, it's wonderful. So this is the problem. We have a population, we have a world in which there's a shortage of people who actually understand fully the meaning of the difference between man and beast. That man is a creature, as defined by Genesis 1. Is made in the likeness of the creator of the universe. This is us. We are, because we transmit these ideas, because we transmit this work as no animal can, we love one another. We love the people who come before us. We love those who are coming after us. We care for them in a very selfish way, because in our spending our talent of life, our sense of beauty depends upon what was coming out of our life in future generations. We love children for that reason. They're our children. We love grandchildren even more than children sometimes. Because our children were able to produce these children. That's great. I mean, you love them specially, and particularly a person who become a grandparent. They love these grandchildren especially for that reason. So this kind of loving is lacking generally in the population. In leaders. Martin obviously had that. Martin was one of the rare people in his time who had a deep sense of what it is to be a human being, who had a deep sense of the lesson of the passion and crucifixion of Christ, and was able to bring to politics, which he didn't go into getting as politics as such. He was a natural leader. The natural leader is one who comes not from the political process as such, but from the people. Martin never achieved political office. Yet he was probably as important a figure of the United States as any modern president. He achieved that. His authority as a leader came from the people. He fought against the people and with the people to free them. He was a leader in a true sense. His power as a political force in the nation and in the world came from his relationship to the people. And that's our situation today, and what I'm so glad to be here and to have this opportunity to be with you. Because you typify those who are struggling in this country and abroad for the so-called forgotten man. As Franklin Roosevelt was summoned in 1933 to the presidency. 80% of the population of the United States in particular and many around the world are the forgotten man and woman. Nobody really cares about them. Take the case of healthcare, the healthcare history. Take the case of all kinds of things. The only way you can renew a nation, as Martin made a great contribution to renewing the United States, is you have to go to the forgotten man and woman, especially to the have-nots. And if you can express a loving attitude toward the problem of the have-nots, those who are on the lower side of life, then you are capable of representing the principle upon which modern government should be based. The same principle that Jeanne d'Arc made possible, in a sense, in her contribution to the emergence of France as the first modern nation state committed to the general welfare. If you want to be a true politician, you must be committed to the general welfare. You must be committed to mankind. And to be committed to mankind is to look at the person who's in the worst condition in general and uplift them. Then you really have proven that you care about the general welfare. If you don't go to those people, you're not with the general welfare. If you don't have your roots in a fight for the general welfare, you're not capable of leading our nation, which is a nation constitutionally committed to the general welfare. Martin had that. All the great leaders of history have usually come out of that kind of background. They were not born leaders. They were not elected to be leaders. Some of them became elected in the course of life, but they didn't start out and establish their leadership by being elected. They established their leadership by finding their roots in the struggle for the well-being of humanity. They became the representatives of some group struggling for that right, or advocate of that group struggling for its rights. And they rose to a position of leadership because they had the moral character built into them in the image of the passion and crucifixion of Christ. And as they get deeper into the business, and it becomes more dangerous as they get more influential, life does become more dangerous as you become more influential, then they realize that they are risking their life. And they have to ask themselves, for what am I going to risk my life? For what will I not? Will I not betray, even at the cost of losing my life? And you're thrown right back to the question of the crucifixion and passion of Christ. And that's where we are today. Martin had that. The problem in the United States and the movement today, as we have in the movement itself, has become too, shall we say, civilized in going along to getting along with the political establishment. And is intending to believe that the road to success is going along to get along, you lose sight of the passion which should motivate the true political leader. The passion is this commitment: you have a talent. You have a sense of what your life means. You have a sense of obligation, a mission in life, to uplift the nation by uplifting a certain part of the population or all of it. And you will do nothing to betray that. That gives you power. It gives you the power of being a creature made in the image of the living of the Creator. You tap it. Martin tapped it. He was a man of God. Not just by God, but of God. He was a man who, in the course of life, destiny gave him the mission of being a man of God. And he had the strength to do that. He had the strength to walk the road of Christ, to walk through Gethsemane, to walk through the crucifixion. He had that strength, as Jeanne did in her own way. And that's the lesson, I believe, that has to be taught, has to be understood if we're going to save this nation. We need to tap in that power. And as I say, in all the images of recent political leaders of the United States, Martin, both as a national leader and as a world leader, which he also was in terms of his influence, is the best example of the kind of personality we must have and must develop to get us out of the horrible, frightening mess that threatens us today. Thank you very much.
William, sister's in still in the house. They are? Have them to come on up, and then after which we'll listen to your remarks. Mother.
First of all, let me say it's a deep honor to be here with you to celebrate this wonderful day. My name is Monica Reynolds. These are three of my four daughters, and it's a deep honor. We thank Mrs. McGee for inviting us here, and we bring greetings, and we're excited to come and celebrate this wonderful occasion. And I thank you for all of the wisdom that you shared. Wisdom, it requires patience. And as I was sitting back there, and we were getting fidgety, God began to say to me, patience, patience. Nothing comes quick that makes you grow. We want something quick. We want a microwave word. We want a microwave everything. We want a quick everything. But he has so much wisdom that he wanted to share and impart. And we just wanted to get to the point. But the point was so much to get to, because there's so much knowledge that needed to be given at that time. So I thank you for the wisdom that you shared. And I will go home and break it down on a level where others can eat, because sometimes we get it. Now we need to go home and break it down to a level where the young people that were maybe bored